Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Blake Hawthorne, the clerk of the Supreme Court of Texas. Welcome to the show, Blake.
Thank you all for having me. I appreciate it.
If you've been licensed in the last few years, you can probably turn around, look behind you, and find Blake Hawthorne's name on your license. He's the guy that signs it. He is the clerk of the court. Blake, can you just tell us a little bit what the clerk of the court does here at the Texas Supreme Court?
Well, I guess I'd describe it as everything from duct tape to procedural advice. I mean, I wear a lot of hats, and you talked about law licenses. That's one of the things I do is I oversee the licensing process for new attorneys. We issue all the law licenses in the state and work with the state bar to do that and run the swearing-in ceremony. I'm responsible by statute for collecting your fees. So when you send in your fees, those fees are made out to the clerk of the Supreme Court of Texas. And that's just one of the things I do. Of course, I'm the clerk of the court, and that involves overseeing the staff and the clerk's office. I have about 10 people that work for me. And obviously, we manage all the filings and all the telephone calls and all that. But then you think about any organization has its sort of bricks and sticks problems. And I work with Justice Green on some of those in terms of, you know, making sure that the courtroom is put together. And when we have new wiring that needs to be done, you know, I'll work with the folks from the DIR that come in or rewire a building. And, you know, a few years ago, of course, we put in webcasting equipment here in the Supreme Court. And we, thanks to the appellate section, recently upgraded that equipment. And of course, I'm involved in all that kind of stuff. I'm the guy around here that knows where all those wires are because I've been here that long. So sometimes I actually even get out on the bench here that's behind us and show people where stuff is and how things need to be done in that regard. So.
And you're also every appellate lawyer's best friend because you have the power in your office to grant unopposed extensions for briefing, do you not?
Yeah, every time I do a CLE and I talk about the internal operating procedures of the court, I like to point that out, and then suddenly I have a room full of new friends if they didn't know that before. So, yeah, we process close to, I think it's about 1,000 motions for extension of time a year. And most of that is done in the clerk's office. If they're unopposed, typically they're just handled by my staff in the clerk's office. In fact, I was tweeting the other day about how long it used to take for us to process motions for extension of time back in the paper days, because that was my homework. I would do all this other stuff during the day, and at the end of the day, I would have a stack of extension requests that I would take home in a bag with stamps, and I would sit at my dining room table and go through those and stamp them and write on there the due date for them, and I would bring them back the next day and hand them off to staff to input that into our system.
That's quite a vision because, I mean, things have changed so drastically in the last, well, within the last 10 years primarily. But so I have to settle an age-old question, I think. Is there any point at all in opposing a motion for extension of time in this court?
Well, you know, I practiced law before I became the clerk of the court, and I had a judge here on the court asked me that before going to a CLE because it was a question that was going to be asked of her. And specifically, though, she asked me about the standards of appellate conduct and what it says about opposing extension requests. And she asked me, does it really matter? And I said to her, well, you know, those are handled in the clerk's office and you should know your audience. And I think it matters. And so that's why it matters. In my experience and practice, one of the things that I hated the most was calling up opposing counsel and having them tell me, well, I need to talk to my client. which I knew would mean that they were going to get back to maybe 2 or 3 days, or I was going to have to call them again and ask them again if they talked to their client yet. And a lot of times the answer was, oh, no, let me, I'll get to that. I'll get back to you. And in the meantime, the clock is ticking, right? And so I encourage people to not oppose extensions. The standards of appellate conduct say that you don't have to, your client doesn't have the right to tell you not to agree to an extension request. There are exceptions to that, I think. And I think the rare instance where I see that I think opposing an extension makes sense is where something bad is going to happen to your client. There's property you're going to lose. There's going to be some concrete injury to your client, and you can't agree to it.
That's really helpful to hear that because some of us, we haven't had that come up, but yet sometimes those opposing counsel, we do get that, well, I have to talk to my client line. And if you can't tell, this is one of my pet peeves. but one thing that does happen is that particularly when you get to the merits briefing stage, you know, the Supreme Court, your office, will sort of telegraph to the parties, we really don't want to see any more extensions. What's the thinking behind that?
Well, we have a system basically that's in place and it's been in place before I was the clerk under a former clerk, Andrew Weber. This was kind of put in place. And we've changed it a little bit over the years, but it's essentially that same system. And we lay it all out in our internal operating procedures paper. So if you want to know how many extensions am I going to get on a brief on the merits, you can go read the paper and you'll see. And you're right. We do telegraph to you. Okay. You're starting to push it when we say no further requests will be disfavored. And then when we say no further requests, we mean it. And that is the rare instance, I think, in which I have seen extensions denied. I've never had the court when I have told them, you know, this is the fourth motion for extension of time to file a petition for review. And with the last one, we told the parties there would be no further extensions granted. And therefore, I think you should deny this one. I've never had them disagree about that. Of course, sometimes even when we say no further, if you're in the hospital, we understand. I mean, we're not heartless about it.
Right.
But typically when we say that, we mean it. So.
You mentioned your internal operating procedures paper. I'd love to make that available to our listeners by dropping a link perhaps in our show notes. We'll try to work that out. There's also another paper that you've written and updated all about the process of preparing electronic briefs. Can you speak to that for just a few minutes?
Yeah, I call it the guide to creating electronic appellate briefs. And it's actually been copied a bit around the country. The Colorado judicial system has taken parts of that, and the California appellate courts have just adopted it whole hog. So it's actually the guide out in California too. When I was, you know, really heavily involved in getting electronic filing up and running, of course, here at the Supreme Court and our other appellate courts, and then getting it mandated around the state. And I felt like in order to make that work, we needed to make the judges happy. So I set about trying to put a guide together that would help lawyers create electronic briefs that would answer some of the complaints that we heard from judges about, well, I don't have my tabs anymore. It's hard to navigate. Issues like that. And so we set out in the guide how you can use bookmarks to help them navigate the brief, really from beginning to end with pictures and diagrams to help you create better electronic appellate briefs.
And, you know, the image of you with the mailbag stamping extension requests from the old days, it kind of brings up a point. We're really lucky in Texas because of your efforts and a lot of other people's efforts. Our court system really is at kind of the forefront on technology. And you've made a lot of steps in terms of making filing and motions and all that far more efficient and more accessible from everybody from pro se's on. Can you kind of talk about some of the things that have changed in the last few years and the efforts that the court has undertaken to really bring e-filing into existence in Texas?
Yeah, when I started, I think the thinking here at the Supreme Court was that electronic filing would go the way it did in the federal courts. And as you know, electronic filing started with the trial courts in the federal courts. And we had electronic filing. It wasn't mandatory, though. It was purely voluntary. We had a system. This was very little adoption of it around the state. And the thinking was that, well, if you build it, they will come. Like if it's better than filing on paper, people will just adopt it voluntarily and we won't need to do anything and it'll just prove itself. And I saw pretty quickly that wasn't going to work. And I felt like the Supreme Court needed to take a leadership role, and that they needed to be the ones showing everybody else how this could be done. And in fact, sometimes the frequent criticism I heard was, well, the Supreme Court's not doing it. If it's so great, why don't you do it? So we did. And we started mandatory electronic filing here. Not long after that, we had it in the appellate courts, and then we mandated it for all the courts in the state on the civil side. And we just had the last court come online for criminal e-filing in Texas. So now we have mandatory e-filing for both civil and criminal cases in all of our state courts.
So all 254 counties now.
It's a big job. We have a lot of counties in Texas, and they have vastly different resources, but we've made it happen.
Tell me a little about, I know you're involved with the Judicial Committee on Information Technology. I have the privilege of being on that committee with you and participating in some lively discussions, shall we say. Folks come there, I mean, for folks who don't know, it's a committee that's created by the Texas Supreme Court. The voting membership is appointed by the Chief Justice, but there's a lot of representatives from clerk's offices, including district and county clerks, the technology, you know, Office of Court Administration folks generally are very involved in that. Did JCIT have a big role in helping to roll out the mandatory e-filing process?
It did. And I would point to one person in particular, Rebecca Simmons, who was a justice on the Fourth Court of Appeals when she took over as the head of the Judicial Committee on Information Technology. And that was at about the same time that we made this change in strategy in terms of trying to mandate e-filing in Texas. And she really helped take the lead on that. And we had a hearing in this courtroom. That was a public hearing where we invited clerks and judges and lawyers from around the state to come in and talk about whether we should mandate electronic filing. And then at the end of that hearing, the court went back and talked about it and decided to mandate electronic filing. Prior to that, though, in all these JCIT meetings that I had been to, people said, well, the Supreme Court will never mandate electronic filing. So I credit Justice Simmons for being willing to ask the Supreme Court to do that, because they weren't willing to even ask before that. So yeah, they very much, they set the standards for electronic filing in Texas. It is a group of lawyers like yourself and clerks like me and judges and some tech people, even from some law firms, and just a very diverse group of people from different roles in the judiciary. And we get in there and we hash out all these changes to the electronic filing system and talk about people's ideas for improving the system and try to move things forward and create a more uniform system for everybody.
Can you tell us a little about the latest project or two that JCIT is working on, or what can e-filers expect coming up?
Well, one of my favorites is something that I suggested a few years ago, which is that we have an automated certificate of service. In other words, the system attaches at the end of your document a certificate of service that lists everyone that was served with the document. One of the reasons I suggested that is that we would sometimes see people certify that they had served everyone and would come to find out that they actually hadn't served anybody. And in fact, we had this, we've launched this automated certificate of service as a beta test here at the Supreme Court. And the Fourth Court now has joined in, and so has the First and the 14th. And I think that Travis County is going to join, and so is the Court of Criminal Appeals as well. And the Seventh Court of Appeals as well. Chief Quinn volunteered to do that also. So anyway, I was saying we're beta testing this, and we have had instances in which people have certified that they served everyone, and then you look at the automated certificate and no one's listed. So it still happens. I mean, it's a mistake that people make, right? But I don't think it's intentional, But this is another thing that I think that we could eliminate, make things easier for everyone, and actually provide better proof for lawyers and judges so that they can see who was actually served and what address they were served at and what time they were served and the date they were served and all that information. One of the things we're hoping to do with it is to actually add a hyperlink to it, which will take you to the e-service, the e-filing page that shows you whether or not that envelope was opened, so that you will even in the future be able to tell if someone actually opened the document. So if you're in court and your opponent is saying, I never got it, then you'll actually be able to have the judge, you know, click on it and see, well, you actually opened it on this date. So that's one of the things that's coming up.
As someone who used to have to carry around big paper reporters and clerk's records in my briefcase, thank you, number one, for going to all the electronic filing and records. Nowadays, it used to be that the Supreme Court would wait and then actually order the record once it was starting to look at a case, but now that's not the case any longer, is it?
It's not. And so because we have electronic records, one of the things that we're able to do when we create a case now is to automatically import the record from the Court of Appeals. And we actually use the attorney portal, which is the same place that attorneys can go to see their record at the Court of Appeals and also for the Supreme Court. If you don't know about that, you should. it's a great, you know, you used to have to go down to the courthouse, right? And check the record out or sit there in the clerk's office for a while.
And wait for the CD to come in the mail.
Wait for the CD to come in the mail and all that. And now you just go online and you see the record. I think one of the great things about it is I think you've got more assurance that the record you're looking at is the record that the court's looking at, because you're all looking at the same thing. So we import the record automatically as soon as we open the case, which could be when a motion for extension of time is filed or when the petition is filed. That record will be there from the beginning of the case, which I think is great. Todd, you'd asked, you know, what are some of the improvements coming down the pike? One of the things that I hope is going to happen in terms of records is that we're going to move away from a system in which you have to designate the record, that you've got to tell the court, here are the things that I think need to be in the record. We've launched a statewide database for electronically filed documents called Research Texas. And one of the things, though, that's missing from it at the moment are the orders from the trial court, because it's just capturing the electronically filed documents. Mm-hmm. But in some counties, like Collin County and Denton County and Dallas County, they're integrating their case management systems with Research Texas. So they're actually, Research Texas is reaching out into their case management systems and pulling in the orders into Research Texas as well. And if we can get to that point where every trial court has all their documents in Research Texas, then I think we can get to the point where the record is just there. And really, you've got the easy button for appeals. You know, you're pushing that one button, I want to appeal, the record is all there. All like we do when we start a case here, we're just importing the docket information from the Court of Appeals. We could do that as well at the Court of Appeals, and I think greatly speed up the process and the ease with which you're able to file your appeal.
Well, another one of my pet peeves for anybody who's interested is the cost of getting a clerk's record. And we see clerks around the state still charging $1 a page or so, even though I'm sorry to my clerk friends out there that are listening to this, but you know, 1,000-page clerk's record isn't what it used to be. You know, it used to be you actually had to physically go and copy every one of those pages. And you could probably justify charging $1 a page doing that. But now, I mean, it seems like it's really mostly just a few mouse clicks. But yet the cost really hasn't changed. And so my hope, if I could inject my own opinion here, is my hope in that development, and I certainly do hope it happens, because we don't need there to be any judgment calls about what goes in the record. It should be mm-hmm. the record like it is in federal court, right? But my hope would be that would make courts more accessible to people who have a difficult time not only coming up with the money to pay a lawyer to handle an appeal for them, but just to pay for the record. And so it seems like that would be a really positive step toward making that happen. I know that we have – you know, some of the clerk's offices, the response to that is that, well, we depend on some of that revenue. And so we have a system that would need to be adjusted somehow. And I don't know the answer to how that would work. But I find it would be very encouraging to be able to look at Research Texas as the source of the record. Because for me right now, what I'm using to look at documents, you know, I might look some days at the Aero system here in Travis County because I can pull everything off of that. But if I look at Research Texas, you know, your point is well taken. The orders aren't going to be there. And so to have one unified system to look at, to be able to gather any document that's been filed in a case and have it be, you know, free or low cost. And I know Research Texas is low cost for non-parties, but free for council record. I think that's it's a tremendous advancement that we're looking at achieving. So, you know, I think that's a great job with putting that together.
Absolutely.
That's one thing, you know, that where we are lagging behind, I think, the federal courts. And it's tough here in Texas because we have 254 counties and we've got elected clerks at both the district and the county court level. And as you say, we've got this funding model where a lot of the money that they use comes from, you know, fees. And so they do have to look elsewhere, perhaps, to find the funds that they need if we're not going to let them charge a dollar a page for records like that. Obviously, you're preaching to the choir when it comes to that. Because, you know, as you know, in our appellate court system, everything's there. It's open. It's available. It's free. I've never been a fan of the PACER fees or the funding model for that. The thing about it to me that, you know, makes that model incorrect is that we save so much money through electronic filing. I remember we were discussing here whether we were going to require paper copies. And some judges said, well, you know, we're going to have to print so much. We're going to spend all this money, you know, printing things. And so I actually sat down with our accountant and looked at, you know, how much do we spend now storing paper? I found that in terms of what we had to pay the state archives to store our records and in the supplies that we had to have to store our records and in the personnel that we had to have in order to file all those things, that we were going to save. We would save money even if we printed four times as much as we were currently printing. So there's a huge cost savings. And I hear this again and again from clerks. They talk about electronic filing is great. I'm saving all this money. I've been able to give people raises because of all the money that I've saved. And somehow that gets lost in the discussion about how much we're charging for things. And it shouldn't, because really there's just such a huge cost savings to the courts. And the fee structure that was put in place was meant to defer those expenses that people were incurring when you had to have a person running the copy machine, and you had to, you know, buy the copiers or lease them, and buy all the paper and all that went into it. And now, you know, it doesn't cost us anything to provide the copies, and the taxpayers paid already for our case management systems. So anyway, that's kind of my soapbox there about that.
Oh, hey, yeah. I'll sit and listen to you talk about that all day long, because I will say in my practice situation, you know, having been in a small firm for 14 years, electronic filing and the way I'm able to manage files now compared to even when I started my firm, night and day difference. And I think you and the court are to be commended for taking the initiative to make sure that we can get these documents. We file them electronically. We don't have to touch the document. We don't have to have a runner go do anything, pick anything up. Heaven forbid we actually have to go get briefs copied and delivered to the court or dropped in the mail by whatever the mailbox cutoff was. I mean, I've been around long enough to where I remember those days of late night post office runs. And so we are in so much better situation than we were, you know, certainly when I started practicing, but it's just been a sea change. And so I think, you know, the appellate lawyers in the state, trial lawyers too, should be very grateful for all the work that's gone into this.
Sometimes they're not. you know, there is a lot of grinding of teeth about some of the, and I understand it, there's kind of a lack of uniformity, I think, with some of the practices, especially in the trial courts about lead documents and things like that. I think in some ways, those differences in local practices, I think, have been amplified by the fact that we have electronic filing. I don't know what it is, whether attorneys are now able to practice in more counties, and so they're more exposed to the differences in our counties, and it drives them crazy, and I understand that. And we're trying to do our best to make things more uniform. What I find, though, is that a lot of people confuse the differences in practices and in the people with electronic filing, and they want to blame electronic filing for the lack of uniformity. And so I'm constantly telling people, you know, it's not the system, it's the people. And one of the things we do again in JCIT is try to get everybody on board and get them all working the same way. It's really tough though when you're, you know, everybody's an elected official and they run their own fiefdom. So it's, we don't have an electronic filing cop. Maybe someday I'll retire and I'll go do that job. But sometimes we could use one. Somebody just telling people like, look, you can't do that. You can't do this. But it's the courts, I think, reluctant to dive into those things and get down into the weeds about some of those local practices. But
well, Blake, we really appreciate you being here and being so accessible both on this podcast and just in general. And we'll throw a Twitter shout out for you. It's at Blake Hawthorne, right?
Blake A. Hawthorne.
Blake A. Hawthorne. And you have all kinds of practical tips, court resources, and things you put out there on a regular basis. So anyone that practices in any of the appellate courts in Texas really needs to follow Blake and pay attention to what he has.
Well, I want to congratulate you guys on doing this. I know this kind of coalesced around
It's your fault, by the way.
Right. Kind of coalesced around some tweets that we exchanged. You guys have been talking about doing this for a while, and so I'm glad you did it, and I'm glad you came to the Supreme Court to do it. So it's been a pleasure.
Well, thanks for having us.
And absolutely.
We actually hope I think that our listeners are going to want to hear from you more, and so we actually hope that you'll come back again and talk with us some more another time.
I'd love to, anytime.
Great. All right.
Well, that's thanks,
it,
Blake.
Thank you, Blake. That's it for today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.